for me, fashion is a verb. So it's to fashion.
My name's Claire Press, and I'm Vogue Australia's sustainability editor. You're listening to Wardrobe Crisis.
I just think it's curiosity at the core of it. Like, I just really want to know the answer to things.
You talk about revolution in 68. No, we make the revolution before.
Can we just go back to making really beautiful clothes with a soul and minimize the waste and think a little before we make things and bring back the value?
Provided you wake up every morning and you're aware of the fact that your wardrobe is in the fashion supply chain, then you're a fashion decision maker.
Join me every week as we talk ethics, sustainability, and the business and madness of fashion. From who made your clothes to how they impact on the environment to the politics of personal style.
My parents feel that this is a waste of time. I tell them, yeah, because everything is just fine.
Happy Fashion Revolution Week, my friends. What have you been up to? Have you been asking brands, who made my clothes? Or perhaps you've been sharing, I made your clothes. I did a post on Instagram recently asking who listens to this podcast while they're sewing. And the answer was heaps of you, whether you're designers or makers or crafters or just love doing creative stuff with your hands. So this episode, I think, is going to chime very well with you. Actually, quite a few people tell me they listen while they're ironing. Not so creative, but I relate. And also while they're walking or commuting. Anyway, have you seen the Fashion Revolution consumer survey results? It's so interesting. It just shows how far the conversation has advanced. I'm going to share some with you. So 85% of respondents said that fashion brands should be tackling climate change. 72% said that brands should do more to improve the lives of the women making their products. And 80% said they ought to disclose their manufacturers. The majority agreed that government has a role to play, and three quarters said that fashion brands should be required by law to protect the environment at every stage of production. I would have to agree with that. Now, this week's guest is my craftivist mate, Sarah Corbett. She is the author of How to Be a Craftivist and the founder of the Craftivist Collective. She's a Liverpudlian, she's charming, and she likes a red wine. We recorded this in her place in London over a bit of a drink. Now, Sarah is the one behind the shop-dropping concept. Have you guys heard of that? It was a collaboration with Fashion Revolution, and Sarah's going to tell you all about what's involved in a moment. We will also hear briefly from the American crafter, Betsy Greer, and she's the one who coined the term craftivist back in 2003. I love these women and how they center creativity in their toolbox for change. And just how cool they are, let's face it. This episode is a call to arms for wannabe activists everywhere. Isn't that you? It's certainly me. It's a demonstration of the political power of fashion and of the persuasive nature of gentle activism. And the wonderful idea that together we might stitch a rebellion, sweep out the status quo and usher in a fairer, more just world in fashion and beyond. Well, I am up for that. Although I have to confess, can't stitch to save myself. I'm like the most reluctant craftivist. Anyway, the concept, love it. As per usual, please do get in touch and let me know what you think of all this. If you've practiced craftivism, if you'd like to, and in support of what cause? Sarah, we're in your house and I'm so pleased because we have actually dabbled with the idea of recording this for a while and also meeting for cups of tea and never managed it.
I think for over a year.
Yeah.
But we persisted.
Nevertheless,
she persisted.
Mm-hmm. That's so nice. I actually, before I came, was wondering how crafty your house would be, and I was very happy to see your little yearbook. Could you tell us what that is?
Yeah. So I've got adopters. So as people might guess, being a craftivist, you don't really get much money, but you do it for the cause. So to be able to do the right work rather than just money jobs, I ask people to adopt a craftivist for £10 a month so I can have a baseline of the living wage and do good work and not just work to pay the rent.
It's like crowdfunding, which I did myself.
Yeah. If you look throughout history, most activists, full-time activists, have got patrons. Gandhi did. Most people did.
Actually, if you look at the arts, and
exactly,
I think when we talk about nowadays, we've sort of, I'm going to say denigrated it, but we've lessened the value of creative pursuits by using that word content, particularly in journalism. Yeah. Like, instead of writing a book or a wonderful story, we call it content, and then it doesn't mean as much.
Quick transactions and not investing So I asked people to adopt me. So I made them a yearbook. So I've got a trolley next to the front door full of yearbooks that are going to go in the post tomorrow.
But that book was open on a particular page and it was showing shop dropping.
It was, yeah.
Now, we're going to get into this a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
This episode is running in the Fashion Revolution Week. As listeners will know, I'm quite obsessed with Fashion Revolution.
So am I.
Yeah, Sarah's got a history of it.
Mm-hmm.
Just before we get into the background of all the stuff that you do, just tell us what shop dropping is.
Shop dropping is the opposite of shoplifting. So for me, that means putting little mini fashion statements, which are beautiful little scrolls that are wrapped in ribbon, into pockets of clothes in stores that could be more ethical, is what I like to say, and people can figure out what that is for them. And you shop drop them. You put them in the pockets of shirts or bags or shoes for people who love fashion and who buy from there to find in their own time.
Think.
Yeah, so they're completely anonymous. They're handwritten with a fountain pen or an ink pen in your most beautiful writing. And there's three different messages that the craftivists decide which one to write. But it's non-judgmental. It's open questions. It supports fashion revolutions. It's about helping people be curious and ask, what's the story behind this item of clothing? Or, you know, clothes maketh the person, what does that mean? So really encourage them. And at the end it says @FashRev for people to Google for more info to see all the different ways they can be part of the solution.
You can buy a little kit, and I did.
You did, yeah. How was that, Claire?
It was super fun.
Was
and
it?
Shameless plug, you can read the story of it in Rise and Resist.
Yeah.
But I like the idea that you're doing something in community.
Mm-hmm.
That could be kind of a lofty phrase for the way that we did it. We just had some friends around for tea.
It was just three of you, wasn't it? Lovely. Yeah.
But the idea being that it sparks conversation.
Yeah.
That you're asking, why are we doing this? Yeah. Why are we questioning the fashion system? What is going on with fast fashion? What do we know that others don't know?
Mm-hmm. And you're
what
not
do
gonna,
we need to know?
You're not going to write the message if you don't agree with it. So you take ownership of it because you've handwritten it. You've made it slowly and neatly. You're giving it anonymously, so it's humble. It's not about you. And you're dropping them in shops, which for a lot of craftivists is quite scary. Some like it, some it really scares them. But it really shows their commitment. And whoever finds it, you're not pushing it in them. You're not making them feel judged. You're offering for them to think on their own, in their own time, on their own, share it with people if they want, or just have a quiet, you know, be intrigued on their own.
Now, if people are listening to this thinking, what? You just say craftivism? What is that? What do you mean? Let's just get down to absolute basics.
Mm-hmm.
What is craftivism, Sarah Corbett?
So it was officially coined in 2003 by an American lady called Betsy Grier.
Ah, Betsy. She is rad. An author, academic and maker who was initially inspired by Riot Girl bands and anti-war activism in the 90s. I interviewed Betsy for Rise and Resist and I asked her the same question. How do you define craftivism? And this is what she told me.
Basically, it's combining craft and activism. In essence, it's using your creativity to create a better world. I focused on the terms craft and activism because when I started this in 2003, craft was seen as something that was like not cool. And activism was something that I was having a hard time understanding. Activism, just holding a placard and waving it, that was not something that was effective for me. So I kind of wanted to talk about them in different ways. And I was at my knitting circle and I was talking about it and it's like, I think they're connected. And what was amusing to me was that I had told two guy friends about this idea and about how they were related. And they both said that was stupid. And then I told like a room full of women and they were like, what? That's amazing. And then one of them was like, you could call it craftivism. And I was like, oh, okay. So I went home and Googled it. And it had been used in a workshop by a group called the Church of Craft. And so it had 4 hits on Google. And at that time, my background is kind of in social science and I'm kind of a dork. So I wanted to see what would happen if you had a word that only had, say, 4 hits on Google. You could track it. Right.
Who found you and why do you think they found you in the early days?
I have no idea. But I do know that like at first it was really funny because the women in my knitting group would be like, someone was talking about craftivism today. And like, I don't know, some friend or something. And they had for a while, you could always track it back to me. like, oh, well, someone, I was telling a friend and then a friend told this friend and then whatever. So, you know, because the people that were involved in craft at that time was fairly small. And I had talked about it on a website called Get Crafty as well. And so people were kind of, you know, talking about this kind of exploration of how craft and activism can go together, because I just wanted to have an idea that I wanted to share and that I wanted people to take and use it in their own way. People have been using craft as a way of resistance and a way of affecting change for hundreds of years. I just wanted to call more attention to the power behind it. And if people want to call it a trend, then that is their right. But I will come back and say, look at all these things that have been happening since way before we were, any of us were twinkles in our parents' eye, even before our parents' time, our grandparents' time. And it'll keep going, you know, whether people use the term or use something else entirely. And that's what's exciting about craft to me, is that you're making and you kind of join this thread, you know, kind of pun intended almost, is of people that have been before you. You're there now, and then people will go, you know, after you.
People like Sarah Corbett.
I got into craft as an activist in 2008 and saw lots of elements of where I thought this could be really useful in activism. And what, how I like to explain it is, it's a bit like the word punk. When you think of punk music, you got all these different bands that sound completely different. And that's like craftivism. If you Google craftivism, you've got loads of different variations. And my approach, I call gentle protest. So activism is always the priority and craft is the tool, not the taskmaster. And it's all about doing careful and courageous and compassionate activism, using the process of craft to slow down and think or chat with your mates, doing small and beautiful objects as catalysts for conversation and thought and action, building relationships with politicians or board members or other people as critical friends by giving them gifts to say, we believe in you, that you spent hours making. So there's lots of ways to do it, but I think the most effective way to do craftivism is through gentle protest.
There's so many words that you used then that were very carefully selected that I want to pick you up on and talk about, because it's so interesting. The first one is gentle.
Yeah, often, and I used to be like this as well. I'd think gentle protest, think that's what I do and why it works. But gentleness, I don't mean passive or weak, or, you know, it really is about being loving. But I think loving activism, people just sort of laugh.
Loving each other, but also loving nature.
Yeah.
I'm into that.
And the gentleness for me is about being kind and considered and thoughtful with what you do, and just treating people how you want to be treated. And that doesn't make you a worse activist or a weaker activist. It's actually really hard to be gentle and loving, especially with people who are doing really harmful things. But if you think about the rest of life that's not activism, you wouldn't go to a staff meeting and scream and shout at people or throw eggs at them or say, you're an awful human being. You'd say, did you realise you were doing that? How can we change this? How can we all be part of the solution? So I think that in the 10 years I've been doing craftivism, what's had the strength is doing it in a very respectful, intriguing, encouraging, very strategic way, is this I call gentleness.
When I interviewed you for my book, I'm paraphrasing, but you said something like, sometimes you look at politicians all yelling at each other and you think, if you were in any other context, if you were children, you would be told to behave better.
Yeah.
Come back when you know how to behave.
Yeah, completely. And I find it really weird. I mean, I've been part of so many activist groups, and some of them, you know, like we abuse other situations as well. I joined one group who bought a tank to take to the arms trade fair, to ride to the arms trade fair in London.
Well, Vivienne Westwood drove a tank to David Cameron's summer house, didn't she? Which I thought was pretty good.
Well, but this was quite confusing, because so I said to the group, so how, what's that doing? We're going to close off the arms trade fair.
You and I probably clash here, because I like a bit of drama, but you're always coming down to strategy. It's actually
which
very clever.
Which it needs to be.
You're saying, what are you doing? What's your purpose?
And again, with anything, if we want to make a good jumper, you know, if you want to make a good item of clothing, you need a good pattern, a clear strategy. You need to hone your craft. Activism, you need to hone your craft. You know, I've been part of activism since I was 3, so I've seen what's won, what's lost, what's worked, what's harmed a campaign, what's credited people, discredited people. And at the end of the day, if we genuinely want to make the world a better place, we need to hone our craft in activism. So when these lads took a tank to the arms trade fair and I said, what's the strategy? They just wanted to go on a tank, and they used activism as their excuse. And it was frustrating.
There's so many things that every time you say something, I'm like, I wish I was taking little notes in my little red notebook, because there are so many words and phrases I want to pick you up on. But I can't let that go past. I've been an activist since I was 3.
Yeah, well, my mum jokes that I was an activist in the womb. So I grew up in a very low-income area of the UK, Everton in Liverpool, in the city Liverpool, in the 80s. So pretty bleak in lots of ways. We had a Thatcher government and a very corrupt council, so double whammy. My mum was a nurse and then a full-time mum, and now she's a politician, a local politician, and doing really well. My dad's still the vicar there. So at the age of 3, there's a photograph. I say age of 3 because I've got evidence. There's a photograph of me outside a row of social housing, family housing, with big banners everywhere to say, save these homes. And I had my little beaker. I had an awful mullet, listeners, that I'll never forgive my mother for cutting my hair, looking confused. And we won that campaign. I've got friends that live in those
Mini
houses.
Activists.
So it's always, you know, our back kitchen, the vicarage, was the hub of the community of people of all faiths and none, talking about campaigning locally, globally, stuff on South Africa apartheid, stuff on local health centres we didn't have. It was part of our blood.
Obviously at 3, you're not going to figure this out,
no.
But it dawns on me that often when you speak with people who have built a life on campaigning or in activism, or indeed anywhere really, but early wins give you momentum. So
yeah,
when you can
definitely.
See that something can work,
yeah.
Then that gives you, I guess, the incentive, but also the hope and belief that if you keep on doing it, you can change the world. Is that good then, that early win stuff, that when you're in local activism and you see change?
I think there's pros and cons. It also means that you can't give up easily and say activism doesn't work, because you have seen that it works.
I like you.
And I don't want to give up. I know campaigning can work, but I burnt out, which I think, yeah, I nearly gave up because I thought I'm completely burnt out. I'm not being very effective. I'm treating, you know, in my jobs, training people to be activists, which is the only job I can do, really.
Well, hang on, rewind. So as a mini 3-year-old, you were at a demo and then... How did your journey into... I hate that phrase, I'm going to say
my
it again.
My journey.
I know, it's so awful. Actually, I'm going to leave it. How did your journey progress?
So we won that campaign because we got lawyers involved, we got bishops involved for media, lots of elements of why we won, because it's very rare for squatters to actually win to save the houses, and they're still there. And then won lots of other local campaigns. At school, I won lockers for my pupils, my peers.
What do you mean?
So the first thing, I was voted head girl, not because I was popular, because I was a geek and everyone knew I knew about campaigning, because that was how I grew up, so I could chair meetings and all of that. And every year, I bet it was the same in your school, every year all the students said, why don't we have lockers like American people have? And I thought, yeah, why don't we? We're carrying heavy bags. It's not good for us. It's taken up time and space. So I asked the head teacher and she said, it's a health and safety issue. And I thought, is it? So I asked the caretaker and he said, oh, I don't think it is. So I said, well, should we measure the rooms and find out? So we measured the rooms because they're all the same each floor, realised it wasn't. And then I didn't do petitions or demos. I'm, you know, an introvert, as you know, so I sort of avoid that. But I found out how much it would cost. I got 2 parent governors who were the most influential governors.
How old were you?
I was 16.
Right.
Got parent governors on our side, which I knew would help, and got other teachers on our side and presented it to the head teacher, who went, yeah, all right then. So I knew it. I think for me, that was a tipping point of, I knew you could win a campaign without having to do demonstrations, have placards, do petitions. You didn't have to. You just ask why and then find
make
a way.
Make a logical argument and present possibility that has to be put into place.
Yeah, and it's hard to say no when you've got a nice, robust argument, which is what a lot of my campaigning is about. Or, you know, shop dropping that creates a conversation but gets global media, which we got, which was another element for that campaign.
You then went on to work professionally as a campaigner.
Yeah.
So you worked for Oxfam.
Yeah.
How did that all pan out?
Again, I think that I'm a geek on activism, so I want to make the world a better place, but I want to do it well, and I can see a lot of flaws in campaigns where people don't realise who the decision makers are and they target the wrong person. And again,
they just all go out in the street and rant
and have a rant and feel
have a
good
tantrum.
And feel good for a bit, but then don't achieve anything and don't think activism can work. So I want to do effective activism. That's what gets me up in the morning, is to do it well and to help other people do it well. So that's always been what I'm passionate about. So then that was the only job I could go for, really. So worked for Christian Aid, worked for Oxfam, worked for DFID, the Department for International Development, and I still work a lot with loads of charities.
You've given a TED Talk. You had great
TEDx
hair.
Talk.
It's
love.
Still TED, mate. Come
but
on.
It was a TED Talk of the day, so it's... Yeah.
Woohoo. And also...
But not a real TED Talk, people.
It is for me. I just can't even imagine how scary it is to stand on that stage and do that stuff.
And it was to 1,500 teenagers. And we all know teenagers are the hardest audience. Yeah, it's quite scary.
Well, I just wanted to say you had very good hair. So your mullet was behind you.
Did
I'm
I?
Sure you had plaits.
I had plaits.
On top of your head,
like,
which I loved.
Hair. Yeah. Yeah.
I love Heidi hair. In that talk, you... Tell the tale of if someone can't find you at a gathering or in a party, where are you? Or were you?
I still am. I'm in the toilet, people, which most introverts are. Thing is, I did that thinking, it's to 1,500 teenagers, that's fine. I can tell them this story. I had no idea it was going to go on the TED website and be watched over a million times. And now I get people going, I know where you're going to go. Should we have a talk?
Yeah, we can always find
Sarah.
Can
we have a chat in the queue for the toilets? I'm like, oh.
No, but come on, why do you do that? So it's yeah. all about this idea of being drained, isn't it? From giving too yeah. much and feeling that you've given all you possibly can, trying to get people to sign a petition or trying to do the campaigning work, but you're an introvert.
Yeah, which I only realised literally about 4 years ago. I read Suzanne Cain's book, Quiet, because I thought, yeah, quiet, and I do quiet activism. I had no idea what introvert meant, really. It wasn't in my general vocabulary. And the more I read, I was like, this is an epiphany. This is why I burn out so quickly. This is why I'm really good at quiet conversations and not mobilising lots of people. So extroverts and introverts, and it's
you
a spectrum.
And me. I'm the extrovert.
I know. This is great because my sister's an extreme extrovert and I'm quite an extreme introvert. So it's basically...
So define it.
Yeah. So it's about where your energy comes from. So as an extrovert, you are seeking stimulus constantly from people, from things, from, you know, rides, from horror films. You love getting stimulated. Introverts stimulate their own thinking so much that any extra sort of tips them over the edge.
So when you were a little one and you were in your pram and you were looking out of the window constantly,
you
looking
have read
at
my
everything
book.
Around
yeah.
you
yeah
and you can't stop looking at the world and you're just yeah. taking it all in yeah. and thinking about it even
my
as
dad
a, even
said
as a
when,
baby
my dad said when I popped out I mean popped out what 18 hours of labor for my poor mother when I popped out I was just looking around and I had spiky black hair.
I had a head of black hair.
Oh,
see this blonde?
It.
I am a fake blonde, but honestly, I'm still a bit of a blonde. I had black hair.
Black spiky
like a little
hair.
Mohawk.
Yeah, I had a faux hawk. We both had faux hawks. Yeah, when I was in a... when we'd have a...
I'm just drinking wine and thinking, I'm going to get us some baby pictures and
I'll
put them in the show notes.
I'll send you mine, you send me yours.
And maybe listeners can also share their baby pictures and we can all have a laugh.
Yes, please.
And then get back to activism. So,
yeah,
the introvert in you.
Yeah, so I love being on my own. I love going to the cinema, reading lots, thinking loads, which is helpful for strategy. But you can often go, oh, I don't want to go on that march. It's exhausting. It's too loud. I'm really good at one-to-one conversations. I like deep conversations. My sister loves conversations with loads of people and loves chanting and mobilizing. So she was always a much better activist than me.
But so actually, to put this in perspective, it could be quite stressful, maybe that's the wrong word, but draining, tiring, and, you know, something you have to build up to.
Yeah, definitely.
To be out
and then
there.
I'd need a nap afterwards when my sister or you would be full of more energy
yeah,
and go to the pub.
Yeah, couldn't sleep, want to go over yeah. and talk to everyone about
I'd
it.
I'd be completely wiped out even though I cared so much and I'd want to do more. And I'd always be like, I don't understand this. I care just as much as everyone else and I'll work really hard to be a good activist. And then I realised as an introvert, 90% of our activism is extrovert or quick transactions, lots of stimulus.
So just quickly, is it true that around a third of people are introverts?
A third to a half. Mm. So again, if you look at, you have to see it as a spectrum and everyone sits somewhere on it. So ambiverts are in the middle.
Okay.
So
what
John,
does that mean? I don't even
so
know the
that,
word.
So that means that you're good in both situations. So you can be drained a bit from either.
I
event.
Don't know the word because I know ambidextrous.
Yeah,
you can
so
use
it's ambivert.
Hands.
So there's a difference between shyness and introvert and extrovert.
Figuring out that you had this tendency to a very common half of us probably
yeah.
personality type, that's one thing. But at what point did you put that together and think this impacts my enjoyment of and obviously you were still achieving, but my enjoyment of activism.
Yeah.
And then at what point did you put that together with this idea of being an activist in a different way? It's fascinating.
It is. And it's that organic journey. I never planned to do this, but it did just naturally happen. So, you know, in 2008, I absolutely burnt out as an activist and I was traveling the country, training people to be activists, working for DFID, and I get travel sick. So I couldn't read my report or do my emails. And like I bet lots of listeners here will totally get, I missed using my hands and being creative and not just tapping on a laptop or
every
a screen.
Listener of the Wardrobe Crisis podcast went, because we have so many lovely listeners that love to sew.
Yeah.
So many people message me and say that they actually listen to this while they're sewing,
while
they create crafting or knitting or designing.
And
or
using your
cutting.
Hands while we're listening to you means that we engage more deeply in it. So it's a good thing to use your head, hands and heart together. So I used to love to paint, but I couldn't do that on a train. So I picked up a tiny cross-stitch kit of a teddy because it was cheap and portable. And what I love about craft...
It's softy.
I know.
Why was it a teddy? I didn't know that.
It was just tiny and it was cheap. It was the only one. I didn't know what to do with it. But I wanted to make something with my hands. I'd never done craft before. But what I love about craft is it is accessible. It's just little crosses.
And you can do it while you're
traveling. Exactly. So I started doing it and I immediately noticed it slowed me down. You can't separate your thread too fast because it'll break or knot up. There is a way to do it, as some of you will know, and I don't teach that way. So by separating the thread, I immediately noticed how tight my shoulders were, how shallow my breath was, how shaky my hands were, how impatient I was, how I was really worried about whether I could carry on being an activist or if it was completely not for me.
So it's sort of a centering.
It really made you mindful of your body as well as how you were feeling, which in any activist group, I'd never, ever been asked or asked anyone else, how are you feeling before we react to everything and plan everything? And then by doing this repetitive action, it was very soothing. It calmed my brain down. It helped me clear the anger and the worry and the fog. And there's so much that clinicians and neuroscientists now have gathered so much data around repetitive hand actions with craft, of how amazing it is for critical thinking. So it gave me this comforting tool to ask myself really uncomfortable questions that if I wasn't using my hands to do something, I could go in a downward spiral. So okay. I had a few hours making this teddy, which I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but the repetitive action was therapeutic, meditative. It helped me ask big questions of, can I be a good activist? How can I do it? And exactly the same journey, my neighbours opposite me were saying, what are you doing? Because it was quite unusual, still is, to craft on a train. And weirdly, with my brain and background, I said what I was doing, but my immediate thought was, oh, if I was quoting, you know, if I was stitching a quote from Gandhi, we could talk about that.
Yeah.
So the fact that no one normally in Britain talks to each other, especially in London, the fact that they initiated a conversation and I wasn't saying, look
actually,
at me.
Really powerful, isn't it?
It was so powerful. And again, I read a lot on psychology.
And strangers, complete strangers. So
complete
not
strangers.
Someone with whom you obviously have something in common and not someone you're travelling with.
And it's, you know, I read a lot on psychology. So looking back, I know now that the fact that they initiate a question means they're more open-hearted and open-minded than if you think of a lot of activism where you're demanding and people's attention and people go into fight, flight or freeze mode. So our actual brains go into survival mode. When you're in survival mode because you don't know what's going on, you physically can't hear properly.
So this is, for example, if you're on walking through a protest and you're surrounded by people who seem to be high energy slash potentially angry, you wonder if there's going to be trouble, you feel hemmed in, and then someone shouts at you, mm-hmm. we want whatever it is,
Which,
all of the stuff.
And there's strengths to that.
So your reaction is to...
to close off. And the strengths to it is you get media attention, it's a nice clear demand, you can galvanize people towards it, we need quick responses as well. But I missed in my activism doing, you know, getting people to sign petitions and going on marches, there wasn't a space, even in activism planning meetings, we just plan lots of stuff. There wasn't a space to go, oh, I'm doing this, what do you think? What would you put?
So it's almost like the quiet and the mindful aspect of the handwork and yeah. just the focus that you
so
have to give.
So on your own, you can just do it on your own in your bedroom and have really deep engagement of the complexities of injustice. What's your part to play? Where can you be part of the solution?
You've really got to apply your mind to it, though.
Yes, I'm totally thinking,
yeah, yeah, there is
which is why
missing
I have,
element to
I
this.
I have
yeah.
craft of thought questions and I'm pretty tough in my workshops.
Otherwise it becomes, I mean, I'm just thinking.
You could just watch telly yeah. and do it. Watch Strictly.
And people do.
Yeah. And all
something
of,
to do with my hands.
Yeah.
And that's
all,
different.
I mean,
though.
All of my craftivism is text-based. So it's actually quite hard to do whilst you're watching TV in case you make a spelling mistake. And again, you're not going to stitch something you don't agree with. So you've already decided because you're investing time and energy into it. But it's totally...
So you're not going to stitch a sampler that says, more coal, please.
Exactly. Because you might do, but it would be a bit odd if you don't believe in it. And by making something,
so it's almost the act of planning it and the act yeah. of deciding to do it is the first
yeah.
step.
Yeah. And then doing it, you're committing to it.
Cross stitching.
Mm-hmm.
Embroidering a hanky.
Yeah.
Shop dropping.
Yeah.
Rattle off some other forms of craftivism for people that may not know or haven't considered before what they might be.
So different projects. So you've given a gift to people that spent hours to do it. Often we make stuff for ourselves as a physical reminder to remind you to be that good global citizen you want to be.
Or you could get a tattoo.
Or, well, like,
I know
I
it's
do,
not crafting,
I do
but
that
I do
as
think
well.
It's interesting.
I've got lots of tattoos to help me on my journey.
I just had to ask you because I know it's not obviously craftivism, but I thought before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about how you need to remind yourself constantly to stay on track. What are your goals? What does success really mean to you? Why yeah. are you doing what you're doing?
Yeah.
And I was saying how professionally it's easy to get sidetracked and start freaking out about little things that don't matter. And then you forget the reason that I do this work is because I want to change fashion and make it more sustainable.
Yeah.
And you told me the story about your tattoo.
Yeah, I've got jigsaw pieces on my arms.
Why?
To remind me to be a really good jigsaw piece in the puzzle, but I'm not the whole puzzle.
Because movement building, which is what we're both engaged in
yeah.
different areas,
yeah.
is obviously not about one person.
And you can't have it on one person, no. and it's not sustainable, it's not effective.
Well, it's ridiculous. So it has to be everyone, it has
exactly.
to be a movement.
Which is humbling, which is a good thing, and helps you focus and not focus on the wrong things, like how many followers you've got, which often we all get distracted about. So yeah, being a good jigsaw piece in the puzzle.
And so the craftivism equivalent of that could be to make something that reminds you in your house. I like
yeah,
it.
So we have footprints people make. We've got stitchable change makers, which are letter pressed dot to dots of different change makers. You can learn from them and how they've used their context, their influence, their skills.
So tell us about how you use the School of Gentle Protest in order to disseminate these ideas and get people to access them.
Yeah, so for me, it's the gentle protest is where I think there's a real benefit. And I think for me, craftivism is one tool in the activism toolkit. So when you care about an issue, we shouldn't see it as a movement or I'm only a craftivist, I do this. You should say, what's the issue I care about? Open up that toolbox and say, do I need to do a march? Do I need to do this? Do I need to do that? Where's craftivism helpful and where it's not? And I was asked to do a 6-week like residency project online and offline. It was around the Magna Carta. It was an anniversary of the Magna Carta on human rights. So I said, oh, well, let's do a School of Gentle Protest, which isn't just craft. And more people around the world were wanting to be more effective in gentle protest.
There's obviously your book. You can find out stuff on Instagram.
Yeah.
How popular is this? And I want you to talk to me a little bit about the take up of it, because
yeah.
when I first discovered the concept of craftivism, I thought it was quite niche, quite weird, very intriguing.
Still is.
But kind of like a weird, bonkers sideline thing.
Yeah.
Now I feel like actually this is gathering pace.
It is, definitely. And I think the book helped. I mean, I wrote the book to challenge people to say you can, like anything, you can make a good dress or you can make one that falls apart straight away. You could make craftivism that might look lovely, but what's the issue? What's the strategy? So the book goes through all of the strengths and also hints at a lot of the weaknesses.
But why do you think people are so keen to take this up?
I think it's changed. So when I started in 2008, and my plan was never for people to join in, you know, I'm an introvert that likes being on her own, but people immediately online, I set up a little blog for friends and family to see what I was doing. And immediately the first person I had was an Australian lady
really?
Saying, what are you doing? Yeah. Can I join in? Then it tended to be people who loved craft and wanted to use it for activism, or people who were burnt out activists or cynical around it, and people who saw activism as something that didn't fit them if they were quieter or more shy, saying, oh, I think I could do this.
But activism is only recently actually become this massive buzzword. Yeah. It's a hashtag.
It is.
It's a thing.
It's fashionable now for the first time for a long time. So then it was people who are interested. Now it's people who say, I've got to do something and I need your help. I've got to do it now. So it's quite different. And, you know, I'm really proud to say that our craftivism projects have changed laws. We changed the law in Spain to protect migrating birds through a craftivism project.
Really?
We helped one of the biggest companies in the UK to increase their wage for 50,000 staff because of one of our projects. And I constantly get lovely emails from people saying, I did your kit and it's changed the way I actually do stuff.
The other day, you were in Colombia.
I was in Colombia.
Speaking to an auditorium filled with 300 people.
Yeah.
Who hadn't even had access to your book in Spanish.
I know. I made them the manifesto in Spanish. I got that translated. I mean, it's amazing. I think there's lots of reasons. We're in a very digital world, and people, for their own well-being, are desperate to get offline and use their hands for good. We know how empowering craft can be.
There's also that disconnection, isn't there, that people fight that feeling of disconnection that comes from all those different factors. I mean, the fact that we're always staring at our screens, the fact that our neighbourhoods are changing, all those things. So we yearn for connection, and this is one pathway to it, right?
Yeah. And then the gentle protest element, again, you know, coming back to, would you scream in the boardroom or would you scream to your friends? Of common sense, we know that screaming at someone might help us in the short term release stuff, but we actually feel worse. You know, we want people to be the best version of themselves. We want to encourage people and we want to find ways to do it. And I'm offering one tool to help people on that journey. The word journey, I'm just saying throughout. It's all about journeys.
The craft of us journey.
And what I love is people are coming from completely different background. So I loved being in Colombia because I thought, is this going to resonate? Completely different culture to the UK, but so much resonated with people.
But you also
people
said before,
totally
different
got
ages,
it.
Men.
Different ages, men totally getting it.
Are some people just not predisposed to be able to do this kind of activism because it requires more attention, more care, more mindfulness, and more quietitude?
It's
some
just,
of us,
it's a habit.
That's hard. It's like, I can't meditate, I don't do yoga.
It's hard, but you can do it. We can rewire our brains. And what I love is it challenges people, but in a safe space. So today I was doing it with this group of staff from a charity, and some were loving how chilled it was. Some found it really difficult, but even that, they learned a lot about themselves.
Yeah, and also anything worth doing is hard.
Well, and that's what's difficult. So, you know, some of my work will not be as popular as other craftivism projects because I'm asking a lot of people. But I know through 10 years of doing it, and we again know through our own experience, that when you do something that's a bit harder, you're much more proud of it.
I know.
You've learned stuff from it. You're more likely to keep it or commit to it than doing something quick and easy. And, you know, I use craft resources, and we're living in a climate crisis, so I'm highly sensitive, as I should be, about how much resources we use. If people are going to use it, I don't want it to go in a landfill at the end of the day. I do upcycle as much as I can and use, you know, our felt is made from post-consumer plastic bottles, which I'm very happy that we sourced that. But it is about helping people as much as they can be the best strategic craftivists they can be, knowing that none of us will be perfect.
We started talking about shop dropping and the Fashion Revolution connection, which I love, and that's how I found you.
Yeah.
But why is it so important for you personally and for us generally to put those two things together, fashion and activism?
Yeah. Personally, I've always loved fashion. I still have a subscription to Vogue that my godmother buys me every year, and I love it.
How lovely.
I've always loved fashion, and I've always felt like, as an activist joining different groups, that I wasn't allowed to like fashion. I was always told that's shallow, you've got to be purist, all of that stuff. And I always thought, actually, we can change the fashion industry sometimes quicker than government. You know, companies can change stuff around quite a lot. PR is a big issue. So if you've got people saying, especially if you've got customers saying, we want you to change, it can make an enormous difference. And I do love fashion, and it's a huge industry that can be changed. There's so many elements to it around environmental issues, around garment workers. We all know that stuff. And I want it to improve. And because there are really ethical brands, big and small, there's no excuse for bigger brands to say we can't do it, because they can do it and they can lead the way.
I also like the idea of the fact that fashion has a long history of, in fact, you could almost say the entire thing is based on craft.
Yeah.
And so that kind of thread. Yeah. See what I did there?
All of it.
That runs through the industry itself, but also then using craftivism as opposed to other kinds of activism in order to shape it, feels like something quite profound.
Yeah, and when you see it, I mean, the first project I ever did, which is still one of our most popular, are these mini protest banners. So they're very small, about A6, like postcard size. You cross-stitch them and you hang them up somewhere relevant to the issue. And as a fashion lover, who then is also frustrated about the ugly side of the fashion industry, I'd hang them outside certain shops with questions or facts on to say, this, you know,
kind of questions.
So questions of, this was before fashion revolution actually, of, I remember the first one I did, it was outside Topshop. So do you remember when Kate Moss did a range with them?
I do.
And I love Kate Moss.
2007, when she stood in the windows.
Yeah. So
in the red dress.
That just came out, and War on Want, Mayhem, who did lots around the fashion industry and still do, had a statistic about how she was given a £5 million contract, but Vietnamese garment workers were paid like 13 pence or something. So I just put those two up and said, is this just? Because it's a big amount. But I think what's good about that is it's not saying what's right or wrong to, so that people don't think for themselves. You could say, well, of course she needs that money and it's probably cheaper to live in Vietnam. So it gets people thinking. I had the War on Want badge for people to find out more info. And I took a picture, got my friend to take a nicer picture outside Topshop in Oxford Circus. And it spread like wildfire on the internet. People were going, oh, who's done this? Where's this? And people still do those banners now. And the street art element, a lot of people really like, but I had sequins on it, so it shined in the wind. It was cross stitch. Yeah. It was next to, you know, it was Oxford Circus with lots of fashion lovers. And if you see a bit of fabric that's delicate and small, below eye level, so you feel like you found it, it's clearly handmade and it's a bit wibbly and wobbly, it's not perfect, you had all these people taking pictures going, oh, look at this. And this was before, you know, Pinterest existed and Instagram existed. People still had this. It's so weird with craft, when someone makes something that's handmade and small, you hold it differently, don't you? You're very delicate with it. The sense of touch and something soft calms you down. So again, that survival element, it makes you engage with it more deeply.
It's so
all of these
yeah.
elements that resonated with other craft lovers and other fashion lovers, because it was textile, because it was handmade. It often reminds you of your grandmother who might have done needlepoint or those generations. What? There's so many elements that really attract people.
But I reckon the big question is, do you have to be good at it? Do you have to be a great sewer? Do you have to be skilled?
I learned from YouTube. So if I can do it, anyone can do it. And actually, if you've never done craft before, that can make you a better craftivist sometimes. So you've got no excuse. I've done workshops for hundreds of people, some people who've never touched a needle and thread in their life, and they have been able to do it. So no excuse, listeners. You can do it.
And no judgment.
No judgment at all. Yeah, just try your best. And you'll see, people will see that in your object, that you've tried your best.
It's getting hard. My parents feel that I'm defending you. I tell them all that they are wrong because I love you.
Thank you for listening to Wardrobe Crisis. To learn more about our guests and the issues that we've spoken about today, hop on over to my website, which is clairepress.com/podcast. You can get in touch there, and I really hope you will. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also find links to my social media. And finally, if you're enjoying the show, please head over to iTunes and subscribe. You know what they say, first in, best dressed. Subscribers are first to find out when there's a new episode, and it also helps other people discover Wardrobe Crisis, so I'd love your help with that. Because the more people who switch on to ethical fashion, the better. Music is by Montaigne. She recorded this special acoustic version of Because I Love You, which is from her Glorious Heights album, especially for Wardrobe Crisis. How good is that? Thank you, Montaigne.
Because I love you. My parents feel that this is a waste of time. I tell them we're okay. I won't admit that I am blind. My friends don't feel that I'm carrying us too. I tell them all that they are wrong. Because I love you. Because I love you. Because I love you, because I love you, because I love you.